presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine, with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with bassist Chip Zanuff from the band Enough's Enough. In our conversation, Chip describes his lifestyle in the 80s and 90s and how he managed to stay alive this far. And he talks about growing up in Chicago and his move to LA in the late 70s. Chip describes his encounters with the Grateful Dead early on and currently. Chip tells us about his early days playing bass and guitar and why bass stuck and why he chose music over baseball. Chip talks about his gear early on and now and what led him to sell off the majority of his gear recently. Chip describes his love for family and how he lived in his aunt's house in LA and the support of his father early on. Chip gives us the rundown of the heyday of Enough's Enough, managers, Howard Stern, drugs, and the lineup changes, all the stories that will eventually be in Chip's book, which is yet to be published, and a documentary that's on its way. Chip describes being handed basses to play for their videos early on, familiar company names, when he is playing vintage Fenders and Hamers live and on the album. Chip tells us about what he's doing musically recently and the new album Enough's Enough has out called Extra Cherries. Chip describes his home studio and some of the session work he's done recently. And if you want to find out more about Chip, you can go to his website, enoughsenough.com. That's enoughsenough.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Here's my buddy Chip.
Hey there, Chip.
How are you, brother?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good for my age.
How old are you?
Old enough to know better, young enough to do it again.
Oh, very good.
Again. age-wise, I was born. I believe I'm the same age as you.
Oh, yep. Probably. Well,
I think we're pretty close. You and I. You, what are you, 50?
No, I had a decade.
We're pretty close to each other then. That's good.
Yeah.
Bravo. We're both staying alive and celebrating life.
Exactly. How do we manage that?
Well, James, I think it's a miracle that we did. To be honest with you, the lifestyles that I've lived has certainly been challenging. So I don't know if you've went through the same thing I've went through, but I could imagine if you love rock and roll and the music industry as much as I do, that you found yourself behind the eight ball quite a few times, no pun intended.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You grew up in Chicago or outside of Chicago?
Yeah, Chicago, Illinois. That's right. I graduated from Brother Rice High School. And immediately after graduating, I jumped in a old 1968 Chevy van and drove to Los Angeles and lived at my aunt. Her little house that she had in Norco, California, and put together a band called Degeneration with Peter Blast, Dick Krepp, and Ray Zor. And we went in the studio, made a record, and moved to Las Vegas to play some shows. And one of my first gigs after high school were opening for the Grateful Dead, Boss Gags, believe it or not.
No way. Wow.
And I've been chasing the carrot ever since then, my friend. Well, we had actually... what helped me chase that carrot was we stayed at this person out there that was living in Las Vegas. They had their father owned the Las Vegas Mirror newspaper, and one of the guys in the band was dating their daughter.
Okay.
So we all moved into this beautiful complex and lived there. And we lived on LSD 25 for about 3 months.
Oh, my God.
It was pretty hectic.
Yeah. Were you into the Grateful Dead?
No, now I am now. As I've gotten older, I've really respected what they do. I admire their strut, but then not at all.
Yeah.
I grew up listening to the Beatles. And,
sure, of course.
And Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd, Queen. Those are bands I like to crowd from across the pond.
Yeah.
And I like some underground stuff, too, like Captain Beyond and Crack the Sky.
I haven't heard of that
one. I listen to some strange stuff. Can't Eat.
Yeah, of course.
And I listen to a lot of this stuff that my father turned me on to.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on got into other stuff as well. But I'm a late bloomer with the Dead.
Sure.
Of course, later on I got to meet the guys and was friends with them because my old manager, Herbie Herbert, bring me a couple of shows, and he loved them. And I got a chance to meet Bob Weir and and Bill Kreitzman, and, you know, because Bill used to play with my old manager as well in the band called Cyclops Blues Band. Uh-huh. And so we developed some good friendships back in those days. And I remember hanging out with Jerry Garcia, smoking pot with him over at the Meadowlands in New York.
Wow.
And those were great times. And then seeing, what was that girl, Mountain Woman or Mountain Girl,
yeah,
who used to hang out with the band. I still have the she gave me an ashtray and a candle with a little ball in it after one of the shows. I still have that to this day with my tickets from the Grateful Dead. So, no, it's a wonderful time. So I'm very good friends with Steve Parrish, as a matter of fact. I haven't talked to him in a while, but Steve and I go back a long way. Steve was the Grateful Dead's guy. And,
yep.
A wonderful manager, a great tour guy. Just really has always been wonderful to me, and a great friend.
He liked to yell at stagehands.
Oh, of course, he yelled at me, but I'm still, yeah, I could call him right now on the phone if the two brothers talking together. Him and Herbie were best friends, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And I think Steve's got his own radio show right now in SiriusXM, so he's doing very well for himself.
Yeah, right on.
You know, I got to call him. I'm glad you brought up, because I got to give him a call, because my wife's grandma used to go out with Scully from the Grateful Dead, the manager, in the early days. So she's got all those early transcripts from the book. She's got R. Crumb postcard.
Oh, wow.
You know, with R. Crumb writing a letter saying he'd had no time to produce it or to do the artwork on the record because he was real busy with other stuff.
Yeah.
She's got stuff that's worth a gold mine. Honestly, got old posters and everything. It's just fantastic. And I wanted to talk to Steve about it. Maybe he knows somewhere where I can give it a better home
and
wet my beak. Yeah, so that old Grateful Dead stuff, you can't go wrong with that. It's worth it's very, very lucrative in this day and age.
Oh, of course.
And of course, now after all these years, I definitely respect the Dead. I look to them as purveyors of the jam band circuit.
Yeah.
They've done a wonderful job. And the other ones, too, that was great when we lost Jerry. They kept it going for quite a long time. It's a band to celebrate no matter what, because they've left an indelible mark in the music industry.
Yep, yeah, for sure. Were you playing music in high school?
Yeah, I was, actually.
And were you playing bass, or were you playing guitar, or which, what?
In the early days, I was playing bass, I was playing guitar, and I was singing as well. And, you know, I had great influences growing up, and I really worked hard honing my chops. I remember I had two cassette tape machines, and I'd play on one of them. I played my parts, and then I'd play it again on the other machine so I could do early overdubbing. I didn't know anything about 4-tracks and 8-tracks.
Yeah.
You know, I was just by trial and error, I learned what I had to learn to do as a musician. But yeah, from the early days, I was always playing. I wasn't sure if I was going to do this or play baseball, to be honest with you, because I was into sports. I love music, but I love sports as well.
Sure.
I was a pitcher, and as a young kid, I tried out for the Kansas City Royals, Milwaukee Brewers, Cincinnati Reds, Chicago White Sox. Wow. And I think at the end of the day, my dad said it best. He goes, "Son, you got more to say throwing a forkball or a slider than a song." And I said, "No, I think it's the opposite way, Dad. I think I have more to say writing a song than throwing a forkball or a fastball." And maybe he was right there. So, you know, after years and years of playing sports, I took the good things from sports and I brought it over to being in a band, which is, democracy, taking, letting everybody have a little bit of a say so.
Yeah, working
and,
as a team.
And looking out for your fellow brothers and having some discipline and not getting jacked up all night. And then the next day you can't play and you can't do anything. So, I took a lot away from being in a sports team for sure. And it's funny how sports and music go hand in hand. Because a lot of these guys out there, a lot of my athlete friends, they love musicians and vice versa.
Oh, yeah.
So I think we're all swimming in the same ocean together at the end of the day, bro.
Yeah. And so what kind of bass did you have early on?
My dad took me to a car show auction that they had in Chicago I want to say it was at McCormick Place, but maybe it wasn't. It was somewhere else. And 43rd Street, one of the old buildings, the old auditorium.
Uh-huh.
And they had this this auction out there, and he bought me an old 1960s Wurlitzer bass.
Wow.
And a hollow body bass. That was the first bass I had. And I remember it was a big thing for me. I love my father beyond belief, and he seen that there was a spark there, and it was something that I really enjoyed.
Uh-huh.
And so he bought me my first car, which is a 65 Chevy.
Wow.
That was cool. And then he bought me my first bass guitar, which was an old Wurlitzer. Yeah. I didn't even know Wurlitzer had bass back then, but they did. And I remember the headstock had nickels in it to hold the headstock on for tuning pegs, for the tuning pegs, that is, I should say.
Yeah, I got you.
And that's how I learned how to play. And then my neighbors next door, a guy named Keith Kenson, had a band called Mad Dog, him and George Sulski, and Rich Hasdra, who's a drummer, as a matter of fact. And these guys, and Terry King, what a great band. They're called Mad Dog.
Okay.
And they helped me get around and find some instrumentation later on and turn me on to some music stores. And
yeah,
then I grew up from there. But the big influences back in when you're a young kid, you remember those guys. They wouldn't bring me in the rehearsal spot, but they had the window open in the basement. Yeah. And I'd lay down and look through the window and watch some cats playing old Captain Beyond songs and Crack the Sky and, you know, early stuff from Montrose. And it's really wonderful times back then.
Yeah.
And that really set the tone for me as a musician.
Sure. And how did, what gave you the drive to come out to Hollywood?
I was just sitting in the parking lot of a Burger King or McDonald's or one of those kind of stores and late at night. And me and my pals just said, you know, we should just get out of here. There's more stuff happening on the West Coast. And that's it. I went home and I told my mother that I'm packing up and leaving. And of course, she cried. Huh. And then my dad came in my room. He says, your mom says you're moving. I said, yeah, I am, Dad. And he says, here. And he handed me $250. He says, if you need anything else, just call me.
Wow.
Right, which is $250 back then. It was a lot of money, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't know that. To me, it wasn't a lot then because I looked at money a lot differently then. I wasn't money driven.
Yeah.
And I love my family. And my sister, Robin, and my little brother, Rick, you know, we were all close family. But I had something to say, and I just knew that if I didn't leave then, I'd be stuck there forever. And I just, I got in the van that night. We drove out to California. It took us about 2 days.
Uh-huh.
And went right to my father's sister's house, my Aunt Evelyn.
Uh-huh.
And I moved in with her and my little cousin, Danny. Danny DeSlober, who's now a big rock photographer for all the concerts. He's fabulous.
Okay.
And I lived there for a couple of years, and we rehearsed in that house in Norco, California.
Yeah, yeah.
We had four girls on one side, three girls on the other side. They come over and visit us every single day, watch us rehearse. We had all these songs. The band was called Degeneration. We had Fleetwood Mac's manager that was interested in taking us and getting us a deal. And my aunt's boyfriend, James Wolverton, who was a guy who was into real estate, was watching over the band and helping support us and making sure we can eat. And we had some good times, and the band should have been much bigger, but we found drugs and alcohol much more appealing. and we missed the fourth quarter. That was it.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody went back to Chicago, tucked the tail between their legs. And I remember coming home, and perhaps failure means getting it right the next time.
Sure.
And that's exactly what I did. I came back and I put together Enough's Enough, and voila, the rest is history. After 5 years of slugging it out, playing every little small little venue in the world for no money, opening for BTO and Cheap Trick and everybody, finally ended up getting discovered by Doc McGee.
Uh-huh.
And him, along with my manager, Bob Brigham, helped us procure a deal with Atco Records, which is a subsidiary to Atlantic, and I had a career, and I was lucky.
Yeah.
But I learned from my mistakes in the beginning, and that really helped set the tone for me.
Yeah. What year was it when you first came out?
When Enough's Enough first came out, we put the band together in late 83, 84, Donnie and I.
Yeah, no, but your first trip in the van.
The first trip in the van with Degeneration?
Yeah.
1979.
Oh, really? Oh, man.
19, I was a kid.
Yeah, it's pre-hair band.
Yeah, well, we were back then, that band, we were listening to the Dickies and Sex Pistols and the Buzzcocks and the Clash. It was a little bit more punk driven.
Yeah.
We loved Blondie, of course, and Television. So just a Brinks truck full of bands. Of course, the Ramones were in there. You can't forget them.
Yeah.
So it was a potpourri of different kinds of groups that we listened to and grew up with.
Yeah, why not?
And,
why not
if you
New
listen
York?
To rock and roll in that band, my aunt lived in California. Okay. It was a place where we can go out there and we can navigate with and be able to survive. I did love New York, don't get me wrong, and I didn't get a chance to go out there until in the mid-'80s when we were going to meet our record company to negotiate a deal. And one of the guys at the label is like 88, I think it was, where Mark Snyder, D. Snyder from Twisted Sister's brother said, "You ever hear of Howard Stern?" I said, "Nah, I'm from Chicago." He said, "Oh, let me bring you over here. I think you guys would hit it off." And boy, was he right. We walked into the studio. Howard was busy. So Donnie and I went to the bathroom and we smoked a joint just to cool out and mellow out a little bit before the show. Immediately they came running in there and said, "Hey, you guys can't smoke pot in the bathroom at this building." We said, "Hey, we didn't know. We're sorry."
Yeah.
And then we went on the show and Howard was just, he loved it. He loved the fact that there was, back then he didn't like any professionalism whatsoever. And he scorned rules and regulations. And here we are coming into his home and obviously pissing on it. And we didn't mean to be disrespectful. We just thought it was, you know, we can get away with a little bit of smoking pot in the studio. And then from there, we just hit it off fabulously. And he started playing the music and he loved that Enough Stuff had different influences that was out there at that time, because metal was predominantly the big thing in the middle 80s and late 80s.
Sure.
Where it was, you know, the Guns N' Roses and the White Snakes and Faster Pussycats and the LA Guns. And there's much, many more I missed. And there was great ones that slipped through the cracks too, like King's X and Doug Pinnick. I love that band.
Yeah.
And we found ourselves, Raging Slab too, that's another band I used to listen to. They're really good.
Yeah.
And we knew that there was a lot of competition out there, but I think Howard liked the band because we had our own timber. And we showed our influences and we wore them on our sleeves. We loved bands like the Beatles.
Yeah.
And we weren't afraid to say it. And I think that was that set us apart from the Motley Crues and the Poisons.
Yep. Oh, for sure. 100%. I mean, your musicality alone set you apart from those guys. So was Doc McGee your original manager? Was Enough's Enough?
It was Bob Brigham, actually, who's got a company now called Nighthawk. They just do all the production for all the big shows. Him and Ron Prozel have this company along with Todd Lapeer. And all they do is when you go to the concerts and you see the big screens behind with the LED screens and all that stuff, that's my old manager. That's what they do now. But in those early days, it was Brigham and Doc McGee. Doc had a lot to do with getting Enough's Enough, our deal over at Adco Atlantic. And we signed with Derek Shulman, who used to be in a band called Gentle Giant. He was great. He signed us, Bad Company, AC/DC,
wow,
and Pantera, all within 6 months.
Wow.
He had an idea and a vision.
Sure.
And he loved the fact that Enough's Enough had Beatle influence. I think that really tripped his trigger because he always loved the Beatles.
Yeah.
And we had a nice little run with it for about a year. You know, record went gold. We traveled around the country, touring with some of the biggest bands. I remember our first tour was with Badlands, Jake Healy and Ray Gillen.
Mm-hmm.
We were playing clubs and small theaters, and 99% of those gigs were sold out. Our agent, Locke Buchanan, was really good. He kept us working the whole time. And then he'd get gigs with us opening for Cheap Trick or Def Leppard. We found ourselves really excited about what the future held. And, of course, we were partying back then beyond belief on those roads. When we left our families, we said, "We'll see you next month," and we were gone for a year. But we found our way around. And those couple tours we did in 1989, 1999 were really big for Enough Snuff. And then Doc said he had a meeting with Bon Jovi, who he was also managing along with Scorpions and Motley Crue.
Sure.
And Bon Jovi basically told him, "Look, I need your undivided attention. You can't be managing all these bands." So Doc came to us. He goes, "Listen, guys, as much as I love managing you cats, I'm getting a lot of friction from John. You know, so I want to give you guys over to who I think is the greatest manager in rock and roll history, and his name is Herbie Herbert."
Okay.
And that was unbelievable. Then he passed us over to Herbie, and Herbie managed us all through our up until 2000.
Yeah.
I think Herbie left us in 1998.
Yeah.
Along with Bob, because he said that we were unmanageable, and they just meaning Donnie, my brother, was unmanageable because it wasn't me. Because I'm still great. I'm still close to those cats to this day.
Yeah.
But he just thought that the band was The inmates were running the asylum. There was no need to. There was no need for their expertise anymore, which was really sad.
Yeah.
And that was the start of us, enough stuff on the downhill spiral. The black cloud has been following us ever since. In 2001, we got a little bit of a break after Doc McGee and Herbie Herbert left the band along with Bob Brigham. I got a telephone call in the morning from Troy Blakely from ours, from the Performing Arts. Troy no longer with us. It's unbelievable how these great guys are not with us anymore.
Oh, yeah.
And Troy goes, I picked up the phone. He goes, yeah, Chip, it's Troy Blakely from APA. Are you interested in going on a tour? And I said, sure. With who? He says, Poison, Quiet Riot, and Warrant.
Wow.
I have a stadium and shed tour, 73 shows. The girls in the office, out of the 20 bands that we looked at and pulled straws, picked Enough's Enough. I said, love to do it. It'd be great.
Yeah.
And it was, the monies weren't great, but we were hemorrhaging at the time. We had nothing going on. The guys were all on drugs. Couldn't even get a hold of anybody. With no cell phones still at that time. This was 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I remember calling Donnie on the phone and saying, hey, bro, what's up? He goes, yeah, what do you want? You know, not very happy to hear my voice evidently. And I go, I just got us a tour, man, with Poison, Quiet Riot, Warrant. Click. Man. Dial tone, don't hear nothing. And I was like, unbelievable. Finally, after three more tries, I got a hold of him. I go, bro, I got the tour for us. We're going to go out with these cats. He says, well, we got to talk about it because I can't go out unless I stop at a clinic and make sure I'm okay for these shows. I said, well, do whatever we got to do to make that happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And the rest of it's in my book, the whole story, okay, where people can hear the hell, the H-E double toothpicks that me and the band had to go through. But we ended up doing that tour. I remember I brought out my old 1970 Tweed Marshall 100-watt amplifier.
Wow.
And I brought a 1969 Chicago police helmet that I got from the riots in 69, beautiful Chicago police helmet, and a couple of killer jackets and stuff, and a small little drum kit that I had that I found at an antique shop, and I gifted to all the guys in Poison the finest gifts. I wish I could have them back right now. Talk about being an Indian giver.
Oh.
I had the greatest stuff. I gave it away because I was so appreciative of those cats helping us lift that black cloud from us and giving us one more chance to play sheds and arenas.
Sure.
And the tour was a debacle for us. I mean, it was obviously there was good moments that were there, but we got in trouble. We had a propensity to get in trouble at any single moment on that tour, and we did. But it left an indelible mark, and to this day, I'm still friends with the guys that are alive right now. And it's just some good memories there. And when I put my book out, I'll be sharing all those stories and all those war scars and tattoos of my career and the early times and the middle times of Enough's Enough, where we found ourselves behind the eight ball plenty of times, no pun intended.
Yeah, yeah. So your book's not out yet?
No, sir. I think the documentary will come out first.
Oh, there's a documentary?
There's a documentary. It comes out next year that we've already shot. It's fabulous. I think I saved every dat tape, every piece of film from 1984 all the way through until now.
Yeah.
We went through everything. We transferred everything to hard drive.
Yep.
The director, Bob Osborne, went through everything, and we cut it all up, and I think we got a nice hour and a half of a documentary showing Enough's Enough from the early days all up till today. And it's really, really profound. Not to sound unmodest, but I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, of course.
And more importantly, it gets us a chance to celebrate the music of Enough's Enough.
Yeah. How did you get hooked up with Derek Frigo and Vicky Fox?
I was on accident. We had a crew guy in the band that worked with us. His name was Jeff Pishaw. We call him O'Darby. And we were looking for a drummer for a while. And he goes, hey, man, you got to get my cousin. He's great. He's in a band called Lickety Split. And I go, what's his name? He goes, Vicky Fox. I go, all right, you know what? Send him over to my pad. I lived at his place in Blue Island. It was 2231 Prairie, where we did a lot of our demos in the early days. If you get enough rarities mm-hmm. on demo records, you'll see all that stuff. And all the history is printed on that record.
Cool.
And so he brought Vicky Fox out to my house, and he sat down. He was a beautiful man, the look of the world. And he played me a cassette tape of his band. And I go, who's playing drums here? He says, that's me. I go, who wrote the song? He goes, that's me. I go, who told you the parts to play? He goes, I just did it myself. I go, okay, you want the gig? He says, yeah, I do. I said, all right, you're in the band. We have rehearsal next Monday over at Trust Rehearsal in Chicago on Grand Avenue. He goes, okay, great, bro. We hung out for a little while. That was it. That was the rehearsal. That was the audition. He never hit one drum, didn't do nothing. He looked so good, sounded so good, such a good cat. Yeah. I just had a wonderful vibe and he had a great electricity about him. And then Derek Frigo, that was on accident. We had a great guitar player before him, a guy named Alex Kane. He used to be in a band called Holland. He went out later on to join Life, Sex, and Death and co-write those great songs that have influenced Marilyn Manson.
Sure.
And Slipknot and all these bands.
Yep.
And he was the guy in the band. He was writing the songs and playing with us. It was fantastic. And we're at Royal Recorder Studio doing the demo tapes. And it was the management company that said to me, "Chip, this guy's yelling, saying he's more innovative than Eddie Van Halen." And I go, "Well, you know, he's got his own timbre. Yeah, you got to say that much, you know." And they said, "We want to bring another guy in to play some of these guitar solos." Oh, and no. I go, "Who's that?" And they go, "A guy named Derek Frigo. He used to be in a band called Le Mans." I go, "No, guys, I'm not interested in that. You know, I can't babysit that fucking guy. I know he's good, but I like the gang the way we have it right now." And he said, "Chip, we're paying for the recording time. We're paying for the studio for you. We're just asking you, let him come down and play a couple songs." Now, we've already shot these demo tapes that we had that we did, and we couldn't get arrested for walking naked down the middle of the street of Michigan Avenue. I had no choice. I was bullied into it.
Yeah.
So I said, "Okay, let's bring him down." So he came down at 2:00 in the morning. Our friend Dan Davis showed up with an ounce of cocaine. We had a bunch of cocktails. There was some prostitutes with the guys. It was a debauchery of a session.
Uh-huh.
But Derek went in there and played his solos on New Thing, Fly High, In the Groove, and For Now, and Babe, and I think there was one other song too, maybe Indian Angel. 5 songs he played guitar, just the solos.
Yep.
We kept all of Alex's guitar parts on there because it'd be too hard to pull all that stuff off there.
Sure.
They went down. Derek Shulman happened to have his band. I guess there was a band that was in the studio recording over there, and then they found out that Doc McGee was bringing Skid Row into the studio as well. So Doc came down there, and we took the cassette tape with the stuff with Derek playing the solos. We played it for him, and he goes, "This is really good, you guys. Let me give it to my guy over at Echo Records. He just signed Cinderella and Bon Jovi, and I think he might be interested in working with you cats." And so we sent it. I mean, these are the same demos we just sent out with the band the way we were.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get a deal, but now all we had was a different guitar solo. That was it, guys. A month later, we had deals from every single record company.
Wow.
Capitol, Roadrunner, Epic, Warner Brothers, Atlantic, Atco. It was incredible.
Yep.
So we had no choice but to grab Derek and bring him on board. And Alex wasn't mad at all because he put together Life, Sex, and Death, and they signed the Warner Brothers, which is an even bigger label, if you ask me.
Yeah, yeah.
And he went on to wonderful, great things, and it was my job to babysit Derek while he was in the band. Boy, I took a beating there, trust me. My nickname was Big. Every time I reprimanded, my nickname was Big Bird. But I won't say that I didn't have a good time watching him play guitar. He was a big fan of Alan Holdsworth. He loved Joe Perry.
Yeah, yeah.
Great guitar player and a lot of fun to work with. It's just those quite a few hiccups within his time in Enough's Enough, especially between him and Donnie, because they both had substance abuse problems.
Okay.
And when he did leave, I definitely shed a tear when he left, when Derek left the band, because he was a big part of our sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we lost something. When he left, Enough's Enough lost a step for sure. We had the songs. Donnie and I were writing the songs.
Yeah, yeah.
But we lost a little bit of a step when he sashayed, because he was a big part of our timbre.
Yeah, of course, of course. You were using Charvel and Jackson basses early on, right?
No.
No.
No, just Fenders and Hamers.
Hamers.
Joel over at Hamers gave me a bunch of 12-string bass guitars, and I made friends with Peterson and Nielsen and the guys in Cheap Trick, and they gave me a bunch of stuff as well.
Yeah.
So it was just Fenders, old Fender Precision basses and jazz basses, and 8 and 12-string Hamer guitars.
Okay.
That's all it was back then. Those fucking guitars you see me at MTV playing, that was stuff that was given to us. Record company cut a deal with them.
Okay.
And those companies were giving Donnie and Derek all those guitars.
Okay.
And they said, and they were just, you know, they go, "Chip, we want you to play them." And I go, "All right, I'll play it, guys, for you guys. As a favor, I did that, okay? I never played any of that stuff on any of the records." Nothing wrong with those guitars.
And
God bless those companies. They've done a fine job, but they came to me only because I was getting a little bit of traction through MTV and radio we had some action happening, and they wanted the whole band to be seen playing their axes.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That was nothing I've ever used on any single Enough Snuff album or records I've played with Missing Persons or or Dave Elfson or stuff I've done with the London Choir Boys. Any of the bands I've ever worked with, I've always used the old Fenders. That seems to be reliable and dependable every single time.
Sure. So what's your bass collection look like right now?
I sold everything to my manager, his partner, Ron Prozel.
Okay.
He's got all my guitars right now. I have a couple of axes. You know, I use the 63 Precision. I've used that on every single record. That's a staple in my life.
Yeah, of course.
All my 12 strings and 8 string basses and stuff I got from Elvis Costello's guys, and all the killer stuff from Cheap Trick. That's all I got in the warehouse right now. I still have it. It's you know, basically I was trying to stay alive, so I sold a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, no, I got.
But I sold it to a family member, a real brother, who told me anytime I want to get the stuff back just to grab it. But I don't even tech anymore. I'm traveling around in the Oscar Mayer Wiener Wagon on these tours. I'm teching myself.
Yeah, of course.
So I just bring one guitar with me, and that's it. If I hit a tour where we were playing sheds and arenas, I was on a fucking bus like I used to be.
Yeah.
And touring like the old days. And I had a guy who can help me tune my stuff and get ready to go. I'd bring 3-4 basses with me, but there's in this day and age, it's consolidation is the name of the game, bro.
Sure. And what are you using for amps?
Right now, old Fender stuff that I got, but you know, my studio in Chicago, I'm still endorsed by Mesa Boogie. I love their stuff. I love the old SVT amplifiers. Uh-huh. I always request them when we play in the outdoor theaters, the festivals. Yeah. It doesn't matter. I'll play through anything as long as it works. But on this tour I'm on right now, I'm out with a band called Pretty Tied Up with, coincidentally, Alex Kane from Life, Sex, and Death. Uh-huh. And the Ramones is with me. And on this tour right here, I'm just using an old Fender amplifier and an old Fender bass guitar. You know, we're playing nothing but Appetite for Destruction in its entirety every single night. It's jam-packed, great crowds. People like those bands, and the GNR experience is pretty special. You want to go see the real GNR? Save your money up for a whole year. It's going to cost you $500 to $1,000. You want to see Pretty Tied Up? By the way, check us out, prettytiedup.com. You see a rock band that comes really close to the incarnation of Guns N' Roses.
Sure. And Enough's Enough's got a new brand new record out, right?
Brand new album, Extra Cherries, featuring some great rock stars, some wonderful collaborations. It's getting great reviews around the country, and we're playing some of the songs live in concert along with our catalog.
Okay.
I'm really happy. Number 21 for us, bro. It's a miracle I'm still making fucking records, okay?
Yeah. So are you going to tour that record? Like, is Enough's Enough going to go out and tour that record? Or?
Yeah, James, I just finished it. Yeah, we just finished the tour. Okay. In North America, we were out for about a month, and then I jumped on this tour. We're pretty tied up.
Gotcha.
And I'll finish this run in the middle of August, and I go back out with Enough Snuff once again. And a lot of gigs, a lot of summer fest, and I think October is a big long run from October through November with Trickster.
Oh, okay.
Cool. So it'll be nice. A nice little package. They have a new record coming out as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll be out touring the rest of the year. No doubt about that.
Yeah.
And I'll be playing songs off. The Extra Cherries record in the set list, you know, No Cold Feeling, you get heavy metal in there.
Yep.
Mixed in there with Moon Thing Fly, Michelle Baby Loves You.
Yeah, of course.
And perhaps some of the songs off our Beatle record too, James.
All right. On.
We did a Beatle record four or five years ago called Hard Rock Night. It's Beatles songs from 1967 through 1970.
Right on.
So Eleanor Rigby and Dear
Great
Prudence
song.
And Magical Mystery Tour. Yeah, so we'll be mixing that. We'll do some stuff off McCartney's earlier stuff, maybe Cold Turkey from Lennon.
Uh-huh.
And we mix those Beatle and Lennon songs and McCartney songs in with our Enough Snuff tunes. And it's an evening full of fucking hit songs. That's what I like to do.
Yeah, right on.
I want to play songs that people recognize, they embrace, and they celebrate.
Yeah, of course. And they engage in.
Every single night.
Yeah.
Look at the reviews. Enough's Enough. Doing very, very well there. Hopefully, we'll get a consolidated tour where we go out, because that's the day and age that we live in, where you get 3-4 bands together.
Yeah.
And that would really help a lot, because you reach a bigger audience that way.
Yeah, of course.
And you're not confusing motion with progress.
Yeah. And where's home for you now?
I'm living in Chicago, Illinois.
Very good.
A little small town called Blue Island.
Okay.
Where Moses left his sandals.
Yeah. That's the place.
Yeah, it's nice.
And when you're not doing music, what do you do? What do you do for fun?
That's what I do. That's my fun.
Yeah.
If I'm not on tour, I'm in the studio recording.
Okay.
I get a lot of requests from people. I just did a couple of songs with Dave Elfson from Megadeth.
Yeah.
On his record, I play on the whole London Choir Boy record, the Black Eyed Sons.
Yeah.
Great. I just produced a Marchese record. I know there's a lot of good stuff that I've been a part of that I'm really happy about.
Yeah.
And that's stuff I'm missing too. I get discombobulated. I knew enough material. There's solo records that I do.
Yeah.
I get called from bands all around the country.
Right on. Do you have a studio there in your house?
They just call me from England. I just play on their record.
Yeah.
I'd have to write down everything that I've worked on the last year because it's a Brinks truck full of material on albums and records and just the recording, singing on people's stuff. The new Zen from Mars is out right now. ZFM, that's a great band right there that I played on at a whole record.
Yep.
So it's hard for me to promote and push everything because it's a shortcut to thinking. I mean, I keep forgetting on what I've done, but I know I've had a luckiest history. I've done a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I just try to stay sharp and go out there and try to help out everybody that's asking for any help because I figure I just help you steering in the right direction, at least give you the right bass parts or guitar parts or melody line for a song. And that's what I can do, and that's what I do. Okay. Yeah. At this point in my career, it's just like I'm excited about finding a way where I can put a smile on your knitted brow.
Do you have a studio in your house?
I certainly do. Yeah, I'm using Pro Tools 10. I have a 2-inch tape. And I also have I have one 2-inch machine down, a Studer 2-inch machine down the basement. I have a 1/2-inch machine as well. I run a snake up to the first floor, and I allocated one of the bedrooms out to a recording studio. Got some great outboard gear, some killer microphones, some U87s, U67s, and I just go in there and I bunch of 58 microphones and 57s, and I bash it out. I do the drums downstairs, and all my guitar parts and bass parts I can just do right upstairs in the studio in the control room. So. It's pretty Sesame Street.
Yeah.
And that's where I do a lot of the records. But I also work at different places. I worked at CRC for years and Stonecutter Studio down in Chicago with Chris Diamonds, a real nice place to go record in as well.
Yeah.
And also Galaxy, too. Galaxy is real nice on the north side of Chicago.
Sure.
So I just try to stay busy and I spread my wings as far as they'll go.
Yeah, exactly. You're a Chicago staple.
That's what I hear. It's nice. I'm getting... We're being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in September.
Right.
Illinois Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inducts Enough's Enough, Smashing Pumpkins, Disturbed, Richard Marx, Head East, and a couple other great illustrious musicians that are out there, too. We're all playing a couple songs.
Oh, right on.
So I'm pretty happy about that, too, James. It's a nice feather in our cap.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, Chip. I really appreciate this. You're giving me this time. And I'm in Northern California, and hopefully if you ever get out here.
Thanks, James. God bless you and your family, and I'll catch you. Absolutely. Yeah, come see us, please, would you?
Oh, I'm coming to see you for sure.
All right, buddy. God bless you.
Likewise.
Thanks again, bro.
Yeah, cheers. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.